caught up in danger in the middle of the storm. Hey, trying to run away from the fear that lies in the dark. Time to fight back, no turning back from the lion den that attacks. I'm a champion, a survivor. But we'll never, ever back down. I'll survive. Get my back against the wall. I'll survive. If I call it big at the night, I'll survive. Until the end of time, I'm a fighter.
Hello and welcome to Strong to Survive. Today we interview Dr. Daniel J. Sonkin, the author of Wounded Boys, Heroic Men. We discuss several topics about male abuse and male survivors. Thank you for joining us. For more information about Dr. Sonkin, please visit his website, www.danielsonkin.com. For more information about Strong to Survive, please visit www.strong2survive.org. www.strong2survive.org. Thanks for tuning in, and please enjoy the podcast. Welcome, everybody, to the Strong to Survive radio show. My name is Eric Lundin. I am your host, and I am the president and founder of Strong to Survive. We are a male advocacy organization built to help male survivors of all forms of abuse. You can find out more about Strong to Survive at www.strong2survive.org. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Daniel J. Sonkin, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist who has an independent practice in Sausalito, California. And I was very inspired by Dr. Sonkin's work when I picked up his book, Wounded Boys, Heroic Men. Inspiring book. It's a man's guide to recovering from child abuse. Very thorough, well-written book. Dr. Sonkin is one of the early specialists in the field of family violence. He's developed a widely used protocol for treating male batterers. And he's written a number of books. He's also done a number of workshops, developed software. He also has his private practice. So, Dr. Sonkin, I hope I didn't leave anything out, but I'd like to welcome you to our show.
Thanks, Eric. It's good to be here.
So, if you don't mind, I'd like to just kind of start at the beginning and what led you to where you're at today as far as practicing in the field of domestic violence and abuse.
Okay, well, it started, well, you know, when I first came to California in 1975, I was in graduate school to become a therapist. And, you know, back then, there really wasn't much written about child abuse or family violence. There were a few academics who were looking at child maltreatment and family violence, but not the general public. Anyhow, I was doing an internship at Planned Parenthood, working with young, you know, adolescent girls and young and adult women who were coming in with a positive pregnancy test and weren't sure what they wanted to do about it, whether or not to carry to term or have a therapeutic abortion. And my job was to help them kind of talk it through and you know, figure out what make the decision for themselves. And so anyhow, one day this woman came in and, you know, she came into the office and we started talking and she took off her sweater and I saw these bruises on her arm. And they looked, It was, you know, something I'll never forget because I've never seen anything like that. And so I asked her, you know, just casually, oh, and her boyfriend was sitting out in the waiting room. She didn't want him coming in. And And she was, you know, so I asked her, you know, did something happen to you? And all of a sudden, there was this just total change in energy in the room, and I it felt like I had said something, you know, really inappropriate, or I had, you know, I had really not fully understood what it meant to her that somebody asked her something so directly and innocently, just, you know, like you would ask anybody, you know, oh, that looks like a nasty, I mean, I didn't say this, but, you know, how you would say, oh, that looks like a nasty injury, what happened? And so she, you know, leaned forward in her chair and just got very quiet, started tearing up, and she said to me that when she found out she was pregnant last week, her boyfriend got really angry, and they got into a fight, and he grabbed her and he shook her. And that was really the first time that was my first exposure to any kind of family violence. There wasn't family violence in my family. I didn't really know anybody. I was in graduate school. There was never any even discussion of family violence. And was really kind of beside myself about what to do. So, you know, we talked you know, went over her options, and she was going to come back the next day. And so in the meantime, I went to my supervisor, and I said what happened, you know, what do I do here? And so, you know, she said, well, just stay focused on the issue of the pregnancy. Don't go into this other stuff, which I was kind of surprised she said. So anyhow, I went back the next day and decided to do the opposite. And so I talked with her more about what had happened, and she, you know, was crying, and it was just, you know, very, very difficult for her. And I then got into the other issue, but after that, it just stayed with me for weeks and weeks. And so I decided to do some research and see what I was interested in male issues back then, and grew up in a family that was very politically active and very involved in the women's movement. And so I was very interested in issues having to do with men and women. And so anyhow, I found some of this information on, you know, Murray Strauss's, who was one of the first researchers on domestic violence, started reading things, started calling around, and really started getting into the work. So then, you know, fast forward maybe a couple more years, and I started working with batterers, and really enjoyed the work because they were needing somebody to help them. And because back then in the 70s, it was all focused on victims, on female victims, and not on perpetrators. And so I started working with the men. Well, you know, little to my knowledge back then, I didn't realize that, you know, the vast majority of the men who were perpetrating violence had also been victims at one point in their life, either victims of physical abuse, victims of sexual abuse. Many of them were victims of psychological maltreatment, or they witnessed family violence in their families, in their childhoods. So that kind of got me interested in child abuse as well. And even then, you know, when I was in graduate school in the 70s, we had like one lecture on child abuse. Now they have like whole classes on whole training tracks on child abuse. But we got one lecture on it. And so I knew very little about it. And again, it was mostly focused on physical abuse. There was no mention of sexual abuse. There was no mention of psychological maltreatment. So I just started getting more and more interested. And I think it had to do with my background in a family where, you know, it was very political and very interested in larger social issues. And this was a huge social issue. And thanks to the battered women's movement, thanks to the advocates of child maltreatment, and not the people who are advocating for it, the advocates who are working in the area of child maltreatment, these issues became bigger and bigger in the late 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And so I kind of rode in on that wave as one of the first people who was working with this population. So I wrote this book, Learning to Live Without Violence, which was a book for perpetrators. And we touched on child abuse in it, but I decided to write another book for the men that I was working with who had been abused as children. And that was the book that you read, Learned, Wounded Boys, Heroic Men. And that was really a book on men who were victimized in one way or another as children. And then you mentioned another thing, which I think is also important, and that is in the last, 10 years maybe, it's been a very, very controversial issue, and that's the whole issue, are men, you know, adult men, victimized in their relationships, and the research, if you look at the research, as much as women's advocates don't like to admit this, the research shows that there are very many men who are victimized by their spouses, that the most common form of domestic violence is what's called symmetrical. In other words, you know, men hitting women, women hitting men, obviously same-sex relationships going both ways, and male on male and female on female as well. And so, you know, over the last 30 years, it's been a really interesting process to see how the field has evolved. And I got involved in other things like death penalty cases where I did evaluations on people facing the death penalty. And in California, one of the things that can mitigate against getting the death penalty. In other words, if you commit a crime that's a capital offense, you can get the death penalty. But one of the things that mitigate against it would be, you know, things like victimization, extreme victimization, either as a child or as an adult. And so, I got involved in all these areas and still do it. To a certain degree today, and I think it's really important work. That's the long answer to your question.
That's great, and I really appreciate you taking the time to give me that thorough answer. I really like that history because I think it's really showing kind of the progression of the societal psyche on the issue of, you know, this deeper, secretive, you know, hidden pain that's going on in the families and behind closed doors of homes across the country. Because, you know, I grew up in a very violent home, and I experienced pretty much every form of abuse that you mentioned. And with the exception of, you know, an adult physical violence in my relationship with my wife. But as a child, you know, I experienced that. I watched my mother get beat, and I experienced physical and psychological and sexual abuse at the hands of my stepfather. And so those things, when I was a child, those things were not talked about at all. And even when my mother tried to get help for me afterwards, when we had managed to get away from this person, there was very little support out there for me as a male who had experienced those things. There was a lot of support for her as a female who had been physically battered, but there was very little for me. In fact, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
She went to the library, I was going to say, to find a book for me, and every book she found on sexual abuse, you know, was using female pronouns.
Right. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's been hard for so many men to come forward, because it's been kind of, put into the societal psyche that this is a female problem, not a male problem. Though that's changing. I would say over the last 10 years, there are more books on male victims and understanding that. And there's people who are, you know, speaking out, and I think that that's really important. But, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into a person just coming forward. I think it's, you know, it's seen as a sign of weakness in some men to kind of say, well, I was abused, you know, And also, you know, when people are abused, they end up doing things that, you know, they feel a lot of shame about being victimized, because the perpetrator often kind of conveys to them that it's their fault. But also, there's just a lot of, you know, if you were sexually abused by a man, you know, there's just all this issue around homophobia and anxiety about what that means. And, you know, or, you know, I do work with the Catholic Church around the clergy sexual abuse crisis. And, you know, a lot of victims, you know, they ended up doing things that they feel really bad about. You know, they may have perpetrated abuse towards others, gotten involved in alcohol and drugs, and so you come forward, and people have all this shame and embarrassment and guilt about not just being victimized, but what they've subsequently done, even though it's related to their victimization. And it's understood within the context of victimization. They feel like, you know, somehow they're defective. And so it's just very complicated in terms of coming forward. And, you know, that's why it's very important, you know, for people to reach out, you know, to professionals or to friends or their family who really are going to understand the issues, rather than, you know, you certainly don't want to reach out to somebody who's going to either blame you or feel like they can't hear it, or somehow, you know, make you feel worse. So the key is to find somebody who's going to understand you and is going to accept you and see your humanity and see that we're all more than whatever experiences we have had in our lives. You know, that we're complex beings, and, you know, even if you were victimized as a child, that's only a part of who you are. I mean, you know, we're all very, very complex and full of a lot of other qualities and other experiences. And I think it's important for people to put it into context, because you don't want to just kind of be a victim. You know what I mean? We're all more than that.
Right. So, absolutely.
So, yeah, so I think but it's changing. I think it's really changing for the better, and I'm happy. You know, like programs like this, what you're doing, and, you know, I think is all contributing to a much needed change in our society.
I agree. I definitely agree, and I think that the more people get together and talk about these issues and look at them and face them honestly, you know, rather than hiding from them, which is what the abusers really, you know, wanted out of, you know, that mentality that kind of is created out of the abuse, and then it's internalized in the survivor as,
right,
you know, that internal abuser that you talk about in your book that wants to keep,
right,
that hidden. But if we can honestly face these issues, and start talking about them, then they don't really have that much power over us anymore. And I think they don't really become this big, scary secret anymore. And we can look,
right,
at them, and we can face them, and then we can honestly find solutions as a means to dealing with them. Eventually, you know, I mean, they're not probably going to go away all the way, but we can look at ways to deal with them effectively. And that's,
right,
definitely my goal with this organization. And I was definitely inspired, you know, like I said, by your book, because there was practical ways of looking at what had happened to me as a former victim. Now I consider myself a survivor of abuse, because these things, you know, these were things that had happened to me, and I didn't understand why I was reacting the way I was reacting to things that were happening in my life. But now, looking back, it's,
right,
like, well, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
You know? So, right, I think it's really important. Men are kind of treated and taught and raised to be a certain way as boys. And when they kind of suffer this trauma, when this trauma is introduced, their coping mechanisms that work during that period, they tend to backfire when they grow up.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, when, right, under the best of circumstances, there's certain coping mechanisms that males use that actually don't help them. It actually, you know, makes things more difficult for them.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that, you know, but again, I think that it's usually even more complicated when you think about it, because in these families where, or just when there is trauma in your childhood, it creates obviously wounds and problems that need to be addressed. But again, there's even more going on during childhood than the trauma itself. In other words, you know, like for some kids, say if a young boy was sexually abused, you know, by a priest when they were 9 years old, you know, that doesn't define who they are. It is just a piece of who they are. Oftentimes in those same families, there's all kinds of other problems, like there's alcoholism, or there's maybe, you know, parents who are, you know, overwhelmed or, you know, by being parents, and there's depression, or there's other issues.
Poverty.
Good point. There's just all these other issues that also contribute to who we are. And so I think the challenge is sometimes when men come into therapy with me who did have less than the ideal, you know, or you know, less than a healthy background, that there's a lot of confusion, like, well, what's contributing to what, and how much of this is defined by my abuse, and how much of this is defined by the poverty, or how much is this defined by, you know, the fact that my parents got divorced when I was 5 years old and I never saw my father very much. You know what I'm saying? There's just so many things that happen in one's life, and it all contributes to who we are. And that's also good, too. There's good things, too. In other words, like, you know, like, for example, we know that there are, from the research, we know that not all people who are traumatized by either physical or sexual abuse or psychological abuse develop problems and
right.
or develop serious problems growing up. And why is that? You know, because there were other things that mitigate against it, like a really close relationship with a parent or parents or a really close relationship, a healing kind of experience with a relative or a friend. So it's very, very complex. And I think one of the things that I caution people about, because, you know, you remember the trauma oftentimes so clearly, and you may not remember all the other nuance, is to not to define yourself solely on trauma, because although it's important and there needs to be healing, it neither defines who we are, nor does it well, you know, it doesn't define who we are, and it doesn't define our problems or our strengths. Some people say, you know, hey, I've heard people say that the trauma contributed to strength in their life, that a certain kind of understanding and an empathy for people that they may not have developed otherwise. So, you know, who knows? You got to be very, very careful about how things are you know, put into what context.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
Yeah.
And I think that was definitely the case for me. You know, I feel like I determined for myself at a young age that the abuse was going to end with me, that I wasn't going to end up like that, and I wasn't going to do that to other people. And that was also solidified by my relationship with my grandmother, who helped me kind of overcome a lot of that with her love and her support. So I think that there are other circumstances that definitely helped define who I was,
right.
and who I became. And then, you know, I also had school and you know, my efforts in school and my abilities to be a good student that kind of helped bolster my self-esteem.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Those kinds of things. So.
Good point. Good point. Yeah. You know, intelligence has been shown to be a very, you know, because it does help to boost self-esteem, because, you know, you do well in school, you get immediate good feedback, and it really helps again, buffer children against some of the negative effects of abuse of all kinds. But then imagine, I mean, think about it. So you could have really serious abuse, like really extreme abuse, like, you know, that went on for years and years. And but at the same time, have this intelligence that really allows you to develop a certain amount of strength and feedback and positive aspects of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then you might have somebody who's just had one experience, one incident of abuse. Okay? But they have learning disabilities that they've always had for various reasons. And they're constantly struggling in school. You could see how that person doesn't have that opportunity to develop that positive self-esteem, because they're struggling with, you know, a sense of feeling inferior already or feeling incompetent. So
right.
That's what I'm saying. It's very complicated. And so when a client comes to see me, one of the things that I do is really spend time getting to know their history and getting them to talk about their story, their life story. And, of course, the abuse is part of it, but it's not always the major part of it. And, you know, what else they discover is both the positive and the negative is important.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you've mentioned how society and the research community is kind of shifting, you know, in the last 10 years and looking more at the possibility of, you know, intimate partner abuse with adult males and in that situation. Can you talk a little bit about that and also a little bit about female sexual perpetrators on male children?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Well, let's just start with female perpetrators on male children. You know, we're hearing more about that. It's obviously not as common as male. Are you talking about female sexual perpetrators, right?
Correct, yes.
Yeah. So it's not as common as male sexual perpetrators. There is some interesting evidence that helps to explain that, and it has to do with arousal, that men are more quickly aware of their arousal. In other words, when they're at a 10% arousal point, men are much more aware of arousal, and therefore they are more likely to feel low levels of arousal during any period of time. And which makes them, obviously, if they have interest in children, it makes them more vulnerable to acting that out. Whereas women tend to not be aware of their arousal until about 40 or 50% aroused. And so if you think about it, make a parallel, like sugar interest. People who handled, who are preoccupied or who are aware that they desire sugar are going to be more vulnerable to going after it than if they're just not aware of it. They're just not aware that they're craving sugar. So there's some evidence that suggests that that's why we see more male perpetrators of sexual abuse than female perpetrators of sexual abuse. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not out there, and it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen, but it does kind of explain why there's such a discrepancy. Now, when it comes to physical abuse or psychological maltreatment, things are a lot more equal. In fact, it's greater with women, physical abuse and psychological abuse. And the reason being is that because of the disproportionate amount of time that they spend with children versus males. So an interesting study that was done a long time ago that showed that women can spend time, much more time with children before losing their patience than men. This goes back to the arousal thing, you know, where it takes men a shorter period of time to become aroused. That for men, when they come home, like at the end of the day, it takes them less time to lose their patience with their kids, whereas women can spend many more hours with children before losing their patience. But when you just look at sheer numbers of who's abusing kids, it's slightly higher with women, but it makes sense because they spend disproportionate amount of time with especially young children. So there's, you know, so you got to look beyond some of the numbers and kind of understand what contributes to the differences. And when people get into a discussion with me about, well, who does more, who's worse, you know, blah, 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 you know, my attitude is, hey, look, all abuse is bad for children, and it's also bad for the people who are perpetrating the abuse because it just contributes to their sense of shame, and that it's important to address it and not get into a numbers game with people, who's doing more, who's doing less, but to just say, you know, it's not a good thing. It's not something we should be promoting in any way, shape, or form in our society. Though, you know, if you watch enough movies or TV programs, you certainly see a lot of it, or cartoons even. I try not to get too much into who's the worst sex, you know, because I just don't think it's a fruitful discussion to have.
Absolutely. I think a better qualifier of my question would be society's response, I think, is unbalanced when it comes to both instances. If you look at an instance of a male teacher abusing a female student, the response to that would be, you know, pretty intense and pretty significant.
Right.
And the response to a female teacher abusing a younger male student typically is met with less intense of a response, and sometimes even met with good for him on some level. And I think that's what disturbs me. And I brought this up in another podcast, the issue of, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but the artist Chris Brown mentioned that his first sexual experience was at 8 years old with an older woman.
Right.
And a lot of the response to that was, you know, good for him. And my response to that was, well, that's molestation. That's sexual abuse,
right.
You know? And,
right.
And I think the society's perception of that, had he been a young girl and that been an older man, would have called it sexual abuse.
Right.
So I think that's kind of what I was getting at is, you know, I want to call these things out because our perception is skewed on this level.
Well, I think, you know, you're right. There is a lot of differences in the way people perceive males and females and abuse. And I think that You know, I mean, sometimes males get a pass and sometimes women get a pass. I mean, I think it just kind of depends on the circumstances. But I think that, well, like, for example, if you look at the clergy crisis, you know, the vast majority of victims are males and the vast majority of perpetrators are males. And there has been a tremendous outcry and from the public, and certainly, although the clergy, you know, didn't handle the superiors did not handle this problem in a helpful way. The public, you know, there was just a kind of a, you know, huge intolerance and anger and outrage. So men were not getting forgiven in any way, shape, or form, or thought of, you know, different, you know, differently than female victims. If anything, you know, sometimes, you know, like you say, that sometimes, especially if a female abuses a male, it's seen almost like, or, you know, it's almost like a rite of passage or something like that, or some kind. That's certainly, I think, is often minimized, and the damage is the trauma of it is minimized sometimes in society. So it's complicated. I mean, I think you're right. I think depending on the circumstances, they're just not handled the same way. They're just not seen the same way. That's why I say trauma is trauma. And it really doesn't matter what the gender is, and, you know, it can be difficult no matter who the perpetrator is and who the victim is. And that's what we need to focus on rather than kind of getting into gender debates.
And that's definitely not my intention, you know. And,
yeah,
and I don't want to discount, you know, the female victims in this. It's just my mission, you know, with my organization is to shine a light on where these issues are with regards to male victims. Because
that.
I think,
yeah, of course. You're right.
It's important.
Female victims have gotten the lion's share of the attention. And it's probably, you know, for a lot of different reasons. One is that there's been a silence on male victims for many years. And probably part of it is this attitude that men can handle it, or, you know, who knows? I mean, I think it's, I'm just glad that it's changing. I'm glad that more and more people are coming forward and saying, this was my experience, and shining a light on it.
Absolutely. I think that's the biggest thing. I think the more, you know, the more we face it, like I said, then it's just like what happened, your experience, you know, not a lot was being done about women victims in the 60s and 70s, and that changed. And I think
right. It
can only change, and things can only get better. So,
you know what I think really helped, and still is why maybe male victims are just not getting the kind of understanding that they deserve. I think what really helped with women victims is when researchers and, you know, really got into the picture and started showing the, you know, the effects. And because, you know, because then it became documented that sexual abuse had all these negative effects on women. And I think that male victims still don't get all the research that they deserve. And I think part of that has to do with, you know, men, like, you know, it's hard to get subjects because a lot of men don't come forward. So if you just look at the number of studies on women versus the number of studies on men, it just, you know, far outweighs the number of studies on men. And so, you know, it's still maybe where we are with men is kind of where we were with women, you know, 20 and 30 years ago, is that we're still trying to educate society and get people to really study this population. And I think that hopefully, you know, 10 or 20 years from now, we'll be in a better place, thanks to programs like yours, but researchers need to kind of get into the picture, and you know, there's lots of interesting books written on male victims, like Wounded Boys, but those are not academic books. And I think, you know, until there's research, sometimes society doesn't really take it as seriously until, you know, somebody studies this population, releases, their research, you know, publishes their research, and then it's kind of taken to another level. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. And I think on the deeper level, the education needs to go to the victim as well, that, you know, that it's okay. You know, it's okay to come forward. I mean, and that's a hard road to fight, because there's so much inherent pride and fear and so many complex things going on in the male victim to come forward.
In men in general, I think that's what you were saying earlier. You made a good point, was that the socialization of men makes it difficult for them to come forward, because there's all this stuff about being strong, about not being vulnerable, by not being weak. And, you know, if you talk about how I was beaten or I was molested, and then there's all the homophobia. I mean, so there's all that stuff that I think makes it difficult for, that's just part of society. It has nothing to do with abuse. It just has to do with the way we raise men in our society that makes it very difficult for them to come forward with their stories. And I don't think women, although women have had a lot of obstacles, you know what women had the obstacle of? Being believed. You know, because, you know, women don't, you know, so that was one of the kind of social, you know, oh, you seduced them or something like that, or you couldn't have been forced, you know. That's all the negative female socialization that kind of made it difficult for them. And I think there's a lot of negative male socialization issues that make it really difficult for them to come forward.
Absolutely. And there's that level as well of not being believed and the fear of not being believed on top
right.
of it.
Right, right. But what could be worse? I mean, let's face it. Every man that I've talked to who is sexually abused, every single man, especially with their same-sex sexual abuse, their greatest fear is being perceived as, if they're not gay, the greatest fear is being perceived as being gay or being outed, or, you know, that by expressing what happened to them. I just think it's one of the biggest anxieties. And the reality is the vast majority of men who were sexually abused by men. So, you know, that's a huge obstacle to coming forward with the story.
Right. Absolutely. But,
you know, we live in a homophobic world.
I think it's important to differentiate, too, for people listening, that, you know, sexual abuse isn't about sex. It's not about sex. It's about power and control and domination.
And
that arousal is a physiological response to being touched, you know, that
right.
it's not
right.
anything to do with your preference or desire for that behavior.
Absolutely. And we just need to keep, you know, bringing home that message, you know, because obviously a lot of men and women feel guilt for enjoying the touch and the arousal, which again is normal. You know, David Finkelhor, who did a lot of research on sexual abuse, you know, he talked about, you know, that this idea that it's you know, what's most traumatic about sexual abuse for a child is that they're exposed. I think he called it, you know, early pre-developmental sexualization or something like that. He used a term that kind of really captured the idea that yes, it's, you know, there's pleasure in being touched, but that you don't want to expose children to this experience before they're ready to really understand and comprehend what it's about. I mean, that's, you know, the reason why, you know, we say, well, you can't vote until you're, you know, 21, or you can't drink until you're 18, or you can't, you know, rent a car until you're 25, you know, whatever, you know, that there are these, you know, that young people need to be ready for certain experiences and to expose young children to sexuality at that age before they're really able to comprehend and understand what it's about is really traumatic and it's inappropriate. And so, not that I think pornography is a good thing by any means, but you know that children and adolescents and even young adults are not really prepared to deal with the what that's all about, and so you don't want to expose them to it. You want to keep them, you know, away from certain experiences because they're just not ready for it. So, I mean, just think about just adolescent sexuality, you know. I mean, parents would prefer that their children wait until they're old enough to really understand the responsibilities and the consequences and what it just means to be sexual. So it's, I think that, you know, that's kind of an element. It's not the only element, but it is one element to why sexual abuse is a problem.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, you're exposed to something before you're really ready to understand it.
When adolescence is confusing enough as it is already without having added pressure.
Yeah. It is. It's you know, obviously, you know, the research shows that kids are having sex younger and younger, and I think part of that has to do with, you know, how we present sex in the media. I mean, I've been around long enough to see how sexuality has changed in TV over the, you know, the past, you know, 60 years of my life, and it's changed radically. And so I think that's contributed to this, you know, kind of more precocious sexuality that we see in young people because it's glorified in the media.
You know, I mean, it'd be hard to prove, but I question if that's symptomatic of a bigger problem in our society, you know, that the sexualization of everything. I just wonder if that's just symptomatic of these issues that are going on in houses across America, you know, that even things that aren't reported, it's just, and in, you know, in churches and in institutions,
mm-hmm.
It just makes me question that because it's like, this is a huge problem and it happens more often than we know than is reported. And we see this kind of increasing sexualization of our society, and it just makes me question, you know, is this symptomatic of a bigger problem than we even realize?
Because I think you're right, and I think that's why it's hard to be a parent nowadays, you know, than it was maybe 20 years ago, because number one, you know, what is, you know, permissible in the media is very different. But now you have the complicating factor of social networking and access to stuff that,
you know, we never had, you had to really go out of your way to get access to when 20 years ago. And so I'm sure all of this contributes. You know, now I just as kind of a disclaimer here, I grew up in a family that was really about civil liberties and civil rights. And so I believe strongly in freedom of speech. And I know that many people will say that this is freedom of speech. And they think that I wouldn't want to see those things curtailed, because if you start limiting the speech of people who promote explicit sexuality in the media, I would hate to see what happens next. But I think parents have a responsibility to do the best they can in terms of managing their kids' exposure to this material, so that, again, that they're not exposed to things that they're not really ready to understand.
Absolutely.
So I guess this happens to sexual, does this contribute to sexual abuse? I don't know. But I think it certainly does, like you say, it contributes to the sexualization of society. And I think it desensitizes society to sexuality. And I'm sure it does have some influences.
Absolutely. So it looks like we've got about 9 minutes left.
Okay.
And I really appreciate you taking time to go through all this with me. I've definitely enjoyed our conversation. Is there anything that we haven't discussed that you'd like to share with our listeners? Anything that you'd like to say to maybe a survivor who's listening? You know, any words of advice that you have?
Yeah. You know, I've been practicing as a therapist for, 30 plus years, And, certainly there are techniques, there are books, there are things that you can use to heal and to help you heal. And I'm a great advocate of information and being informed and using resources to, support groups and things like that. But I have to say, the thing that I have found to be the most healing is the relationship. That when you think about it, physical abuse, sexual abuse, psychological abuse, witnessing violence, all of these things are done in the context of relationships, where people, children who trusted adults, somehow betrayed that trust and made their lives unsafe as a result of it. And so because the wound happens in the context of a relationship, I really come to believe that the healing has to be in the context of a relationship. It doesn't have to be a therapist. It could be a partner or a family member or a friend. But that it's really relationships that heal. Again, don't get me wrong. I think techniques are important, and I'm a big advocate of mindfulness and relaxation, and I know that that's really, really helpful for people. But I think it's also relationships that heal. And so what's key is to surround yourself with people who you trust, who understand you, who accept who you are. Certainly don't accept or don't condone doing bad things, but that, what I'm saying, who basically love you and care about you. And people who love you and care about you will confront you when you're acting out destructively in some way. So it's but being close to having close relationships is what's going to heal. Even though that's the scariest thing to have when you've been betrayed by somebody, all of a sudden you look on relationships as suspect or dangerous. But it's really important to find, you know, a secure base relationship, because that's where the healing is going to take. And then the other piece is just patience. That I think that nobody ever stops being affected by their early traumas, whether it was a trauma of abuse or some other trauma, like a divorce or a death of a parent or a death of a sibling. I mean, these early experiences live with us throughout our lives. But at some point, after you've talked about them and understood them, and, you know, they just don't run you the same way. They just don't define your life in the same way that they once. But you never forget. You know, no, who can ever forget being molested or being beaten or, you know, or seeing the terror in their mother's eye as being, you know, beaten by their father? I mean, you know, who, you never forget that stuff. And that's not the goal. The goal is just to get to a place where it's just not defining all your behaviors and your beliefs and your feelings. And that takes time. It's telling the story over and over and over again. And sometimes it kind of creeps into the background, and sometimes it comes back to the foreground, and just having faith that every time you revisit it and talk about it, that it just gets better. So it's finding that balance between, again, it's finding that balance between, you know, not letting it define you, but understanding that it's affected you. And I think that that's really what helps people heal from these traumas and losses in their lives.
Well said. Thank you so much for those wise words. And if people want to get a hold of you, what is the best way for them to reach you?
They can go to my website, danielsonkin.com, and there's a contact page where they can send me questions or comments. I'm one of those people who actually does return emails. You know, it's amazing, you know, when people contact me through my website, you know, I usually get back in touch with them within 24 hours. And usually the first response was, wow, I wasn't expecting a response. You know, I guess there's a lot of people out there who have websites who don't respond to people, even though they, you know, they say, contact me if you want. So when I say it's okay to contact me, I really mean it. And so if you have a question, if you have a comment, if you read the book and you like something about it, or even if you read the book and you don't like something about it, or you don't like something I said, or, you know, it's fine with me. It's, you know, as long as the conversation's respectful and collaborative, I can deal with criticism. In fact, it makes, you know, it makes me rethink my approach, and it makes me, you know, rethink what I write. And so I heavily depend on feedback from others. And so, go to my website. There's a lot of stuff to read, a lot of articles. There's chapters from my various books there. So I feel very good about sharing information.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for spending your morning with us. I definitely appreciate it. And I can vouch for the fact that you are quick to respond to the conference.
Thanks, Eric. I really appreciate you inviting me. It was really nice to be invited. And so if you ever want to do this again, I'd be happy to do it on this or another topic.
Perfect. Thank you. Once again, if you want to reach Dr. Sonkin, his website is danielsonkin.com. You can also find out more about Strong to Survive at www.strong2survive.org. You can email us at info at 2survive.org. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoy our podcast, and we hope you have a great day.